Welcome back. Your application runs and it's reachable, but right now its settings are baked into the container image, and it has no guardrails on how much processor and memory it can grab. Today we fix both. These are the two levers behind reliability and behind cost, so this is a high-value episode. Let's dig in. First, externalizing configuration with config maps. A config map stores non-confidential data as simple key-value pairs. The whole point is to decouple your environment-specific configuration from your container image. Same image, different configuration per environment, which gives you portability. Think of a setting like the database host name. Locally, it's localhost. In the cloud, it points at a service. Same code, different config map. A pod can consume a config map in a few ways, and the two you'll use daily are environment variables and mounted files. You can inject a single key as an environment variable, you can inject all the keys at once, or you can mount the config map as a set of files into a directory in the container. Now here are the behaviors that catch people out, so listen closely. When you mount a config map as files, updates flow through automatically after a short delay. That means live config reload is possible. But there's an exception. If you mount a single file using a subpath, it never updates. And when you consume a config map as environment variables, it does not update at all. The container has to be restarted to pick up the change. Also, the pod and the config map must be in the same namespace. A config map maxes out at about 1 megabyte, and you can mark one as immutable, which blocks edits and actually improves API server performance at scale. Now, the most important warning about config maps: a config map provides no secrecy whatsoever. The data sits there in plain text. Even Kubernetes secrets are only base64 encoded, which is not encryption. So for passwords, keys, and tokens, use a secret and ideally back that secret with Azure Key Vault through the secret store driver, which we'll cover in the identity episode. My little phrase for this is config map for the knobs, secret for the keys. Now to the second half, resource management, and this is where clusters really live or die. Every container should declare, for both processor and memory, two numbers. The first is the request, which is the amount that is guaranteed and reserved for it. This is the number the scheduler reads when it decides which node to place the pod on. The scheduler makes sure the sum of requests on a node stays under the node's capacity. The second is the limit, which is the hard ceiling the node enforces at runtime. Let me warn you about the units, because there are two classic traps. For processor, one unit means one full core. So 500 millicores means half a core, and the little m stands for milli, 1,000th. When a container tries to exceed its processor limit, it gets throttled, meaning it's slowed down, not killed. For memory, the trap is capitalization. A capital M means megabytes in the decimal sense, but a lowercase m means millibytes, a tiny fraction of a byte, which is almost never what you want. And the binary units, the mebibytes and gibibytes, are the powers of two versions you'll usually use. The crucial difference from processor is this. When a container exceeds its memory limit, it doesn't get slowed down, it gets killed. You'll see that as out-of-memory killed, often shortened to OOM killed. Here's a subtlety about the scheduler that trips people up. It checks capacity against requests, not against live usage. So a node might have plenty of free memory right now and still refuse your pod, because its request doesn't fit into the unreserved portion. That's the classic failed scheduling, insufficient memory event. Now, from your requests and limits, Kubernetes derives a quality of service class, and that class decides who gets evicted first when a node runs short. There are three. If every container sets its requests equal to its limits for both processor and memory, the pod is guaranteed, and it's the last to be evicted, the safest. If some requests are set but they don't fully equal the limits, the pod is burstable, and it's in the middle. And if you set no requests and no limits at all, the pod is best effort, and it's the first to be evicted, the riskiest. I remember it as GBB, best to worst. Guaranteed survives, burstable bends, best effort breaks. So the common failure signatures line up. Out of memory killed means your memory limit is too low or you have a leak. Failed scheduling means your requests are too high for any node. And throttling means your processor limit is too tight for the load. You diagnose these by describing the pod and looking at its state, and by checking live usage with the top command. Requests and limits are per container. But there are two objects that govern a whole namespace, and these are AKS best practices. The first is the resource quota. It caps the total processor, memory, and object counts a namespace may consume. And here's the key behavior. Kubernetes does not overcommit. Once the cumulative requests hit the quota, further deployments simply fail. There's also a powerful side effect. Once a quota exists, every pod in that namespace must declare requests and limits, or it gets rejected. So you usually pair a quota with a limit range, which injects sensible defaults so your teams aren't forced to annotate every single manifest. The second namespace-level object is the pod disruption budget, and to understand it, you need to know that disruptions come in two flavors. Involuntary disruptions are things outside your control, hardware failure, or a node virtual machine being deleted, and you mitigate those with multiple replicas across multiple nodes. Voluntary disruptions are the ones you or the platform initiate, like a cluster upgrade, a node drain, or a template update. A pod disruption budget constrains those voluntary disruptions so that a minimum number of your pods stays running. The scheduler will not drain a node if doing so would violate the budget. This is exactly what makes node upgrades non-disruptive later on. Azure drains a node, but your budget forces it to wait until replacement pods are ready elsewhere first. Let me tie it together. A config map holds non-secret configuration, decoupled from the image. Mounted config maps auto-update, but subpath mounts and environment variable config maps do not. Use secrets and key vault for anything confidential. The request is reserved and drives scheduling, while the limit is the enforced ceiling. And remember, exceeding a processor limit throttles you, but exceeding a memory limit kills you. Watch the units, lowercase m is milli, the binary units are the powers of two, and capital M is not the same as lowercase m. Quality of service runs guaranteed, then burstable, then best effort, and best effort dies first. A resource quota caps a namespace and forces requests and limits, while a pod disruption budget keeps a minimum number of pods available during voluntary disruptions, like upgrades. Quick self-checks for the road. Which value does the scheduler read to place a pod, the request, or the limit? The request. A container exceeds its memory limit. Throttled or killed? Killed. Out of memory. How do you make a pod guaranteed quality of service? Set requests equal to limits for both processor and memory on every container. And which object keeps a set of pods running during a node drain? A pod disruption budget. Your workloads are now configured and resource-bounded. In the next episode, we make them elastic. We'll scale in two independent dimensions, the number of pods and the number of nodes, and I'll show you exactly which lever to pull for which bottleneck. See you there.